Thank you, Dorothy. My name is Grace, and I am an alcoholic. And I only know one thing to do at an AA meeting, and that's to tell you my story. I had my first drink at the age of 13. It was a pink lady. It was on the occasion of my birthday. And I had my last drink on January 26, 1984. So I date my sobriety from January 27, 1984. And in between those two drinks, there was a lot of fun. There was a lot of glamour. But there was a lot of drinking. And then there was just a lot of loneliness and a lot of misery. But how I got there, when I had that first drink, I can't tell you that it set off any immediate compulsion to drink physically. However, mentally, I loved the idea of it. It made me feel like I was grown up. It made me feel like I was pretty. It made me feel like I was smart. It made me feel like I was popular. And all those feelings of less than had no basis in reality. I was a good student. I was a cute kid. And I was popular. But there was always that hole deep inside of me. And my parents said to me, you know, Grace, we want you to know what it is to have a drink. We want you to know what it is. And though we're, so on special occasions, when we would go out, a drink would be ordered for me. And they had the most glamorous, sophisticated names, like Apricot Sour, Brandy Alexander, Rob Roy, and they came in very sophisticated glasses, and they were frosty, and I just loved it. And I didn't drink through high school. I didn't really drink that much in college because somehow along the way, I knew that drinking could make me do things that I might not be proud of. So, and this was a pattern that would stay with me throughout my whole drinking. I always wanted you to think that I was together. I always wanted that good facade out there. And so I would be very careful about drinking in public. And the first time I qualified, and this was not a 90-day qualification, I had a little bit over a year. And a man shared from the floor, and he said, Grace, your story is one of denial. And I didn't understand what he meant at all. Because I thought that everything I did was normal. And to this day, I still think a lot of the things I did was normal. Which is one reason I keep on going to meetings. Because I hear your insanity, I identify my insanity, and that keeps me away from a drink one day at a time. And just to give you a few examples of my denial, in New York City, we can order liquor over the phone, and they deliver it. And every Friday night that I would get home from work, I would pick up the phone, and one Friday, I would order 2 half-gallons of J&B Scotch. Now, I know that predates me. I don't know what liters are. I only know from half-gallons. And then the other Friday, it would be 2 half-gallons of J&B Scotch, which was my drink of choice, 1 half-gallon of the Dewar Scotch for the company that had stopped coming, 1 half-gallon of Smirnoff vodka for the screwdrivers I had on Saturday morning, and a 1/5 or 1/4 of Jack Daniels for the whiskey sours I had on Sunday morning. Now, none of that was solitary drinking because I figured if I were living with someone, we would have drinks, you know, when we came home from work, and if I were going out to brunch on Saturday or Sunday, I would have those drinks. So what did it matter? And it went on like that. When I came and people said to me, did you have blackouts? I said, no. I thought a blackout meant you passed out. I didn't know that it meant that you didn't remember things. And I would go into my boss's office. I was never smart enough to take a pad of paper and a pencil with me. And he would tell me to do something. And I couldn't remember it when I got back to my desk. And I'd figure, he'll tell me later. It'll come back to me. It didn't. And it went on and on like that. I lived at 54th and 1st. I worked at 52nd and Madison. And I beat a path back and forth between those two locations. I never went above 57th. I really never went below 52nd. I never went west of 5th Avenue. And that was my life. I had been active in my church, But the events for my church were always on Sunday afternoon, and how could I pass up my whiskey sours? And I would fix my whiskey sours, and I would have my whiskey sours, and then I would take a nap on the floor of the living room. And then I'd get up and I'd start drinking scotch and fix my dinner. And in 1980, both my mother and my uncle died of this disease. And the last time I saw my mother, the whites of her eyes were yellow. And I knew that was a bad sign. And when I saw her death certificate, it said a heart attack induced by acute alcoholism. And I looked at that and I thought, that's not going to happen to me. I can do better than that. I know how to drink. And after that, though, I would get up in the morning and I would be putting on my makeup and I would look in the mirror and I would look at the whites of my eyes and I'd see that they weren't yellow yet. And I think, I don't have to stop yet. Because I could not imagine going a day without drinking. And how I got here, I recently retired from a clothing company, and we were very proud of the way that our fabrics and our colors coordinated. And I was the person who was responsible for ordering the fabrics. And I ordered the wrong color fabric. And my boss called me into his office, and this was in November of 1983. And he said to me, Grace, I've told you you drink too much, and you have cared to do nothing about it, and now I'm going to do something about it. And with that, he gave me the name of two rehabs, and he said, pick one. And I looked at him, and I said, but Bill, there's Thanksgiving, there's Christmas, there's my birthday, which is on January 1st, and there's that business trip I want to go on mid-January. Can't we put it off till then? And for me, miracle of miracles, he said yes. Which explains my end of January anniversary. I drank through those holidays. A birthday party was given for me on January 1st. I remember what I wore down to the shoes. I remember walking into the house where the party was given, and I do not remember one other thing about that party. I went off on that business trip in mid-January, and our company was young at that point, and it was requested that we share a room with another woman from the company. I met up with a woman in either North Carolina or South Carolina. To this day, I don't know where I was. We had dinner in the restaurant in the hotel. I'm sure I had a couple of drinks, but at that point, that wasn't enough. And my mother had taught me always to travel with a supply in my suitcase. So we got up to our room, and I said, I'm tired. I want to go to bed. I wanted to get to the scotch in my suitcase. And she said, I'm not. I want to watch television. So I got into bed, and I moaned, and I groaned, and she would not turn off the television, and I wanted to kill her. Finally, she turned off the television. Finally, I got out of my bed. I got my bottle out of my suitcase. I took the bottle of the scotch, went into the bathroom, and sat on the floor of the bathroom and drank the scotch right out of the bottle, and that's where drinking took me. It wasn't the nice places my uncle would take me when he was in New York on a business trip. It was the floor of some bathroom in some city that I don't even remember. I came back to New York. I had a couple days in the office, and then I was going off to the rehab. I walked out of the office, did not say goodbye to anyone, figured, you know, they're doing this to me. Let them figure out what I'm leaving is a mess. I got home. I drank all the scotch in my apartment. I got up the next morning. I drank all the vodka in my apartment. I got out to the airport. I drank at the airport. I got on the plane. I drank on the plane. And I could not figure out how the people from the rehab knew who I was. I told you denial. And in that rehab, I began my work into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had to do the first 5 steps before we could leave there. And I did them. And I cannot tell you that I did any of them well or thoroughly. But I learned some very, very valuable lessons in that rehab. I learned that I had to put some work into this program. I learned that I had to read the literature. And I learned about sharing with other women. And I'll never forget, I told one woman one of my deepest, darkest secrets that I probably have shared over and over, but I don't remember what it was. And it was amazing. She didn't tell anyone. And I started to trust all of you. And when I left the rehab, they said, you know, you've got to get a home group, you've got to get a sponsor, blah, 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 blah. I didn't do any of that. I went to meetings, and I listened. And I realized that all of you became my sponsor. Because I heard how you come up with solutions to problems. I saw people arrive at meetings after someone had died and share. And little by little, I began to trust. And little by little, I'm very fortunate. I grew up in New York where we would have the dinner before the meeting in a coffee shop. And that coffee shop was my school. My sponsor would be there, and other women with about the same sobriety as I had were there. And I remember when I was new, I used to have to buy the cookies and the milk for our coffee hour, and the budget was $20. And I couldn't make the $20. I would go over. And I would walk into the coffee shop, and I would be sputtering. I was so angry that I hadn't hit the $20. And they laughed at me. And I didn't get it. I just didn't get it. And then I complained to my sponsor about my boss. And she said to me, it was one of the most freeing things I've ever heard, Grace, did you ever think he might have problems too? And my sputtering started to stop then, because I realized, you know, it was me that was having the problems, not him. I wasn't going to change him. And I learned about bullying at that coffee shop. When I talked about a problem, someone said, well, he's bullying you. And it was like light bulbs were going off. And I'm ever so grateful. I got the wonderful gift of willingness. I wanted to go to meetings. I wanted to do the steps. I wanted to get better. Because I heard that I didn't have to change 90 degrees. I didn't have to change 180 degrees. I had to change 360 degrees. And I wanted that. I wanted what all of you had. Because we hear it's a program of attraction. And you attracted me. You made me want to keep on coming back. You taught me that there was an easier, softer way. I don't understand when people don't want to do what's suggested. I resisted for a while, and it's much easier and much softer when you do it your way. And there are three things that I just want to end with. One, when I had a little bit of time, I was having difficulty in a relationship. And this old-timer from my group, I talked to him about it, and he said, Grace, it's your expectations. And I got it. I was making myself miserable. The second story is in 1988, I had to have some major surgery, and that night there was a group of women in my room in my hospital. And my internist, who was not doing the surgery, walked in, and he said, and he saw a group of you in that room, and he looked in all of your eyes, and he looked at me and he said, Grace, I can tell you're doing just fine. And I have, because I haven't had to go through anything alone, and I know any place I go, I can walk into a room of AA, and you will understand, and you will accept me. And my final story is, about 9.5 years ago, I married a man in the program. And after the ceremony, and all of you were there with us, and after the ceremony, my husband said to me, were you nervous? And I said, no. And I didn't understand that, because he said he was really nervous. And I thought about it, and I mulled about it for a while. And then I remembered the first time I ever chaired a meeting, I was pacing, and I was worried, and this man knew that I was thinking, you know, well, they're going to fire me. They're going to want to get a new chairman. The speaker's going to be terrible. The sharing's going to be terrible. Why did I take this job? And this man took me aside, and he looked at me, and he said, Grace, we all want you to succeed, and for that I thank you.
Thank you so much for that sharing of that peace and serenity that you have today from that time before. And our next speaker will be Tom.
Hi, I'm Tommy, alcoholic. Can you hear me in the back? Sweet. I want to say what an honor it is to be able to be up here and speak. The only thing that qualifies me to be up here is I've maintained a sobriety date, and I've stayed active in AA. And it's led in a direction that situations arise and you meet people and you get asked to speak. And that's the only thing different between me and anybody else in here. And I've got nothing more than anybody else. And but I've been blessed with an abundance of sobriety and wonderful, amazing people in my life. And I want to thank you for coming to my two-hour talk on humility. I had to go in the Georgia Dome and practice it for a few hours last night, and it just didn't seem like a big enough room. And before the meeting, someone asked me if I get nervous, you know, speaking in a big meeting. I said, I get nervous when there's like a small meeting, you know, a few people, you know, because I can see who's not listening. And I'm like, ah, you know. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the only thing that's ever made a difference in my life. A lot of people try to help me for a lot of different things since I was a really young kid. And this is the only thing that's really helped me. And it helped me with my booze problem. It helped me with, you know, maintaining the sobriety date. But a lot of other things had to happen in order to do that. I've been a member of AA. My sobriety date is April 7th of 97. I've been a member of AA, though, since October 1990. And I couldn't maintain a sobriety date because I couldn't get honest enough or whatever the reason, you know, maybe didn't work the steps completely or whatever it was. And when I look back at it, I know for me, any problems I've ever had in my sobriety, it really leads back to that first step that I'm forgetting I'm powerless over this thing. That I think that I have some power, that I think I know what's going on. And my story in sobriety is I'll sober up for a while, and things look good, and I fix the things that brought me here. And the lie that I tell myself is that if I fix the things that bring me here, I'm okay. And I'm not okay, because it's not the things. It's the drink I take after those things that happen that make me alcoholic. If I were to look at the trouble I had in my drinking, I would say all these reasons are why I'm alcoholic. But it's the fact that I would take a drink after those things that happen. That's really how I define myself, that I just still, where all the evidence says you have this thing and you can't drink safety, that... You know what I really need here is a drink to actually figure that out, though. You know, and I, as you can tell from my accent, I obviously grew up in the Deep South and of Boston, and I did grow up in South Boston. Very interesting place to grow up in. I come up from a good family, you know. Both my parents worked two jobs to put me through Catholic school, and there was really no drinking in my home. My father would tend bar a couple nights a week, and he never came home smelling of a drink. When he drank, he didn't change. I didn't become afraid of booze. I had older brothers that were a lot older than me, and when they drank, they were just funny, life of the party, everybody in the neighborhood know them. My brother that's closest to me is 13 years older, so like he was like my older hero, you know. He's a drinker, and he would go to Montreal for the Bruins games and, you know, go to the Final Four every year, go to the Super Bowl, and he went to the Orange Bowl one year and didn't come back for 18 months. And, I couldn't wait to behave like that. You know, I couldn't wait to take that drink. And that's what I looked forward to. I came from a good home, but my life revolved around a street corner, and that was my home, and that's where I learned life's lessons. That's where I developed my morals and ideas of how life was supposed to be. And from a young age, I would develop these ideals, and I would begin to drink, and I would cross these lines, and I would have to lower the bar, so I reached a point, I mean, at a really young age, where I would have to sit on these stairs around the corner from my house and try to sober up because there was hell to pay for drinking when I would go home. And I remember thinking, like, you know, I'm worrying about that trouble and how it's going to affect my family. And I would sit on these stairs. And I'd do crazy things like sit-ups and jumping jacks and, like, try to sober up and eat a bunch of gum. And I'd do all this crazy stuff. But I remember this one day when I walked by those stairs, and I just said, I don't care, because the drinking was worth the consequence for my actions. It was worth it. That the drinking I was doing was worth it, and I didn't care. And I developed an I don't care attitude at a really young age. By the time I was 16 years old, I was in and out of my house. I had been shot, stabbed, and I stood on a street corner one night. I was selling drugs. The progression of my disease did turn into drugs. Doesn't make me any more or less of an alcoholic, because what I realized is I've never once said, you know, tonight I think I'm going to go clean my bank account out. I'm going to do all the drugs in the world and end up naked in your bathtub. I've never gone out and said I'm going to do that. But what I have said is tonight I'm going to go out and have a few beers, and it's going to be all right. And it wasn't all right. And I was naked in your bathtub. But I was on this street corner, and this car pulled up, and it was three guys from Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were, at that time in 1990, they were in their 20s, mid-20s, friends of Dave's, Sean, and Macca, and a couple other guys, And they were talking to me about what I was doing in my drinking and maybe trying to check it out at AA meeting. There was a meeting down the projects in South Boston at the time. There was a lot of younger people sober there. And they invited me to go down there. And I really wasn't listening to what they said. They were older guys that I absolutely respected. So I listened to what they were saying to me. But it was going in one ear and out the other. But in the back seat of this car, there was a duffel bag. And it had some shotguns and rifles in it. And I look at him, I'm like, wait a minute, you're talking to me about going to a meeting, you got guns in the car. And he says, listen, they're all mine. I was just out shooting on my boat on one of the harbor islands. You know, it's all right, it's legit. But something clicked inside me. And I said, guns, AA, maybe I'll check this place out, you know. I kid you not, that is how I ended up at my first meeting. Now, I've seen God work in the most spiritual, profound ways you'll hear about. But nothing could have got through to me like a bag of guns. And that's how God entered my life at that moment. My favorite part of AA is the 15 minutes prior to the meeting, because what you witness is people interacting. They're in the meeting, the group members are talking, they're catching up on their week, they're joking with each other, the coffee's being put out, you know. The business of AA and the interaction is going on, and there's that energy. That was my introduction. It wasn't somebody coming to the podium and giving the best, well-prepared, most educated in our literature talk there ever was. It was just watching people in AA interact with each other. And I loved that 15 minutes prior to the meeting, because that's what hooked me. Because I saw these people that I knew from my neighborhood that should not have been mingling the way they were. There was something about them. And I grew up in a very insulated, inclusive neighborhood. I mean, the people that we grew up with literally would lay down and die for you. But there was a connectedness in AA that I found that I've never seen anywhere else. And I've never had a bad feeling about AA ever since. I didn't stay sober that night because I didn't think I could. I got a little bit of hope that there was a way out. But I said, you know, I'm too young, I'm too this, I'm too that. And but eventually I was in enough pain where I ended up back in AA. And I did what was suggested to me. And I stayed sober for about 9 months. And after about 9 months, I wanted to drink really bad. And I didn't take any of the suggestions that anybody gave me, and I drank. And it was bad for about a month, and I came back here. And I worked harder at what I saw other people doing. And I, you know, found some sponsorship. I will say that I actually found a terrible sponsor. I didn't know it until I got sober years later. But his suggestions, it was like, go to the gym and eat healthy and be good to your mother and go to church. And, you know, they would also do these great things to me. Like, they'd pick me up at my house, and there was a car. There'd be three people in it, but the front seat would be empty. And they'd put me in the front seat. And the reason they would put me in the front seat is because eventually I'd start talking crazy, and they'd whack me, you know. And they'd say, do you ever listen to yourself, you know, and... That was the love and direction I got. But, you know, I was a kid, you know. I probably needed a good whack, you know. But these guys picked me up religiously, and I remember my friend Sean picked me up, and he would pick me up every day for a noontime meeting. And so one day he pulled up, and he had the newspaper out, sitting in front of my house. He's got the newspaper, and he just casually says, hey, you see this section here? I look, he goes, yeah. He goes, this is where the jobs are. You got to get one, you know. And sick of buying you coffee every day. And so he took me on these job interviews. We circled the paper for all the jobs I was qualified for, all three of them. And we went there, and you know, and I got a job. And AA helped me do that. And I stayed at that job till I got a better job. And I was a high school dropout. I wanted to go to school and get my high school diploma. And I could have taken the GED test, which would have been a huge accomplishment, but I met someone in AA that introduced me to something, to like this night school program, and all I had to take was like three classes to get my high school diploma. And I went, and I got all A's, and I got my high school diploma. And it was the first time that I recognized that I took steps of integrity that were leading towards something better that I was working for, because I really wanted it. Because what I believe is, if there's an easy way and a hard way to do something, they're going to get kind of the same results. I'm going to take the easy way every time. Shortcut, yeah, you know, in the end, it doesn't matter. That's what I tell myself. I don't know about work ethic for the sense of doing the work so I can build character, so I can someday lead by example that you too can do this. You know, that's foreign to me. But that's what people were showing me. And, I was at a point, I was 3 years sober, and everything was healed in my life from my drinking. I had a good union job. I remember my girlfriend at the time was in law school. I was racing sailboats out in Milwaukee. And you got to come a long way from selling drugs on a street corner to racing sailboats in Milwaukee. And after a long day on the water, I was reaching in a cooler to grab a bottle of water, and someone said, hey, can you grab me a beer? And I grabbed them a beer. As soon as I had that beer in my hand, I said, man, I want to drink this beer. I deserve to have this beer. You know, it's like cutting and pasting reality to make sense of how I'm going to take a drink in safety. And the lie I tell myself is all the trouble I had in the past was because of I was young, I was this, I was that. And because I fixed these outside things, I'm no longer that person. But at my core, I'm always that person. I still suffer from the same things I've suffered from the first time I've remembered that I've suffered from them. You know? If you can follow that. They're all still there. They're the core things. They materialize in other ways, but they're the core things. It's my cross to bear, and they've always been there. And I drank that beer, man, and it felt good for about 17 seconds. And then I knew I was screwed, and I drank as fast as I could to forget that I was sober. And it's a lonely place, drinking after sobriety. I'm sure everybody in here has stayed sober from their first meeting. But it's a lonely place. You think you're having fun, and all of a sudden you just get caught up in this little silent moment of, I used to be sober. What happened? That was pretty good. And then time passes, and the lie I tell myself now is I'll never be able to get back to that place I was at before. And that drink lasted 2.5 years. My father died a week after I drank. He was 46. He dropped out dead of a heart attack, and I was in a world of pain, in a little world of trouble. And it was tough. And I told myself that I'm going to force myself to stay sober until the holidays. And there was a big thing going on in my union. If I made it to a certain part of the job, I'd be set for years. And right before Christmas, the guys were going out for a beer, you know, after work. And I said, I can go out for a beer after work, you know, Friday, whatever it was. And, you know, I had that beer, you know, never made it back to work. Ruined the holidays, you know, all that stuff that happened. And what I went back to was some severe madness in my neighborhood. And the end result for that was, for me, my bottom was the day I could no longer lower my standards to catch up with my surroundings. Now, I've been sober long enough to know that the particulars of my story, though they connect me to you, for me, I tell myself, you possibly can't understand what it's like to get sober as me unless you're me, unless you've been down exactly my road, unless you've done exactly what I've done, unless you've, you know, had these shameful moments. You know, you can't help me. You can't understand me, you know, and I don't want to have anything to do with you. And it's this huge lie. And I had this really bad bomb, and I had these really bad experiences. But the end result was I had my head in my hands saying, how am I going to get out of this situation? And more importantly, how am I going to get out of this situation and still drink? Because that's really what I want. And I had that moment where I was willing to ask for help. And I was dying inside. I was going to bed at night, holding a gun on my chest, hoping maybe I'd have the strength to kill myself. And I just felt awful all the time. And I was doing awful stuff, so I should have felt awful. But I reached out, and somebody set up an appointment for me to go to a detox. And I ended up at this counseling center for Catholic Charities, this detox program. And I said, listen, I think I'm in the wrong place. And they said, well, you're here. Let's figure out what's going on. And this little Catholic nun came out, and she said, why don't you just come in and talk with me? I said, listen, I'm just trying to go to detox. She said, why don't you come in and talk with me, you know? And I was honest with her. I told her everything that was going on in my life. I was dying inside, and I was desperate. And she just looked at me and said, Tommy, you're screwed. And what I wanted to hear was, it's all right, son. I'm a nice little Catholic nun. Here's a rub on the back. You'll be okay, my boy, you know? That's what I wanted to hear. But she said, the only thing that's going to get in between you and this is Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 Steps and God. And she said, you've been sober and you know about Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, it's clear that you haven't worked the steps, and it's clear that you don't have a relationship with God. She said, I want you to go home. I want you to eat something. I want you to shower. And I want you to get down on your knees and beg God to end this madness. And that's what I did. And I remember that day. It's the day that everything changed. And at that moment, I had money. And I had options. And the life I was living, if you had money and options, you weren't stopping what you were doing. And I remember the only thing I had to eat, though, in my house was this nasty, rusty, dusty can of Dinny Moore beef stew. You know? Yeah, this guy probably knows. You know what I mean? And I forced that bad Larry down and took a shower and did the old you're a piece of garbage routine in the mirror. And I remember I had this turquoise bathrobe. My friend Paul loves this story. But I had this turquoise bathrobe, and I wore it around the house like a smoking jacket, you know. And smelled like a bag of Doritos and blood stains all over the arms. And but I got down on my knees, and I began what's been the foundation of my sobriety. is that I entered a certain situation feeling a certain way. I invited God into it wholeheartedly in desperation, and nothing in my life has been the same since. I got down on my knees. Nothing changed in my life those couple of minutes I was down on my knees, but everything has been different, and I've been sober ever since. I begged God to end this madness, and I said some prayers that were personal to me. And I got up with this little spark of hope. The beers that I had, I dumped them, and the drugs I had, I got rid of them. And I planned on going to detox in the morning. The morning came, and it was a pretty large ruckus. And I should have been very specific about how I asked God to end this madness, because the Boston Police, State Police, and DEA gave me a spiritual awakening. It was a Saturday morning. I never would have been home on a Saturday morning at 7 a.m. I wouldn't have been there. But they came and got me, and I put up no fight. I was like, all right, take me. You know, and I know everyone else up there out here would have gone out in a blaze of glory, all you train killers. But I was beat up, and I surrendered, you know, And I faced that situation. It was an ongoing thing to my sobriety, and I reached out for help, and I went to detox, and I went to programs, and everywhere I went and did the next thing they suggested. And I found sponsorship, and I was down in this area, and they said, listen, this guy's going to be down here. Why don't you look him up? And I went to a meeting that he was at, and I heard him speak, and as enthusiastic as I was about being sober, I wanted nothing to do with this guy. You know, he's one of those sponsors that would really require a lot from you. I could tell. I saw him in a meeting a couple days later. He goes, hey, aren't you Tommy Delaney from South Boston? Didn't so-and-so tell you to come down and see me? And he starts poking me in the chest. And I had to ask him to sponsor me just to shut him up. But the guy saved my life. He introduced me to what it was like to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He introduced me to what it was like to be a man here. I had a lot of trouble going on. And he was humble enough to say, I don't know how I can help you with that. He goes, actually, why don't we go take you to a priest? Because there may be some things that you want to share. And I don't want you to get back in the car with me and think I'm judging you. So why don't we go talk to a priest for a while? And he dropped me off and talked to a priest. I had open indictments and stuff sweating out. I couldn't talk openly about what was going on in my life for a couple of years. But everything got to be put behind me. And the topic of this meeting is peace and serenity. And I grew up with such a pain in my gut. I don't know where you get pain when you get stressed. I get it in my gut. I get, oh, you know. Some people get it in their shoulders, headaches. I always had this nasty feeling in my gut. After being around this guy for a while and following his direction, I remember the day I woke up and I didn't have that pain as severe as it was the day before. And whatever peace and serenity means to you, like, I don't know, for some reason when people say peace and serenity, instantly I'm seeing some dude, lotus position, you know, it just, that's my go-to, you know? And for me, It's not about that. That's one philosophy of quieting a mind for meditation. And the peace and serenity that I have to live with is I found a spiritual life that I believe to be true. You may not have to believe what I believe to be true. I need to live along those principles. There are common, guiding, spiritual principles that we all live by. But when I was new in sobriety, it was suggested to me that I maybe go try to read a book somewhere and just be quiet, that I may try to do this, and I would try to find these things. When I was able to put the court stuff behind me, I moved down Cape Cod for a while, and I was out on workman's comp, because even though I was honest and being sober, I still had a comp case going on, and I got hurt at work. But I did have to have surgery, and so I was able to move down Cape Cod my second year of sobriety. I didn't have to work. I got to go to a ton of AA. And really what I began to do was find a personal relationship with God. And I sought it out for the integrity of having it. And I began to have moments. And I began to have things happen where I felt things that I didn't feel before. And peace and serenity were, for me, might have been, I'm no longer wearing holes in my sheets because my foot shakes for 2 hours before I could fall asleep at night. That might have been peace and serenity at that moment. Because all my sheets had this wear mark at the bottom right corner. Because I had so much anxiety. And I remember falling asleep. I know what it's like to put my head on the pillow now and fall asleep anywhere. Paul and I were flying out here, and I was falling asleep before the plane took off. You know, that's where I'm at. I have a lot of stress in my life. And being peaceful and serene doesn't mean that life's not going to happen and it's not going to be hard. It means I'm going to be able to maintain my sobriety date the best I can through it, and that I'm going to do my best. And it may not be your opinion of my best. It's my opinion of my best. And that's what allows me to put my head on the pillow at night. I found a relationship with God that works for me. I found a relationship with the 12 steps that allowed me to maintain a sobriety date and keep it intact. For any of you checking your watches, we're one speaker short, and I was given the okay to speak a little while. So get cozy. I got an hour and a half on my bottom lip. But I was able to find a relationship with the steps that were able to progress along where I was in sobriety. And I haven't done things perfectly. I'm a swing for the fences type of guy. And that means I strike out a lot, you know? And like, whatever I think I know what's going on, like, I got to remember, I'm the guy that once, maybe a couple of years sober, I flipped a coin to get married or divorced, you know? And married or break up. And we got married, you know? And she's not my current wife. And I got to remember I'm that guy. But what I have is I've maintained a sobriety date despite that. And I've maintained my ability to be a member of AA. And I've had a lot of things happen. And in my story, you know, I went from being, you know, a convicted felon to a project manager in community development. A lot has to happen for those things to swing. I went to being a project manager traveling the country building banks and credit unions. Doesn't happen to convicted felons. Security plans to banks don't get put in hands like that. And but it's all been because of what I've done here. I was sitting in the conference yesterday, and I spent probably about 9 hours by the top of the escalator that was going down to registration. I just let the whole conference come by me. And I've been fortunate to travel all around the country for AA and have friends and conferences and everywhere. And I saw so many people I wanted to see. But what I began my day with was I would find one person. And I'd say, look at that guy. Imagine how many hours were spent by the people that have invested into his sobriety. And just that one guy. Think about in your own life how many people have helped you. And the energy that's in this room. We're here to celebrate sobriety. We're not, I doubt there's anybody here that's like, oh, maybe I'll check this thing out. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Like, you know, I mean, maybe it's like new people like dragged here, I'm sure. But like, we're here to celebrate sobriety. We know what it's like to have people have helped us get over that thing we could never get over so we could stay sober. I know that this room is filled with that. And that energy just bouncing off each other and just so full of it. I spent the day just being so drawn to it. And it's an amazing thing. And it's that 15 minutes prior to the meeting feeling, that connectedness that I have. I always laugh when I hear someone say something like, oh, I don't want to go to that meeting. You know, that meeting sucks. You know, it's like, man, there's sober people there that used to be drunk all the time. That meeting doesn't suck, you know? And it's like, and that's what we fill AA with. You think a meeting sucks, man, go there and make it good, you know? Go bring something to it instead of being someone that's trying to take something from AA. When I was new, all I could do was take. My sponsor had a lot to give, fortunately, and he would spend a lot of time with me. We would drive around. He would talk to me in these parables about AA and always give me these big, long life things. And this one night, we went to meet this guy. He sponsored him. This guy was a wealthy doctor, and he was in a lot of trouble, and my sponsor got out of the car and started poking his finger in his chest. "You don't listen to a goddamn thing I say." And he got back in the car, and after they had a long exchange, and my sponsor said, "There's three things that I've seen as major obstacles in AA. One is an overdose of education. People think they're too smart for this. Two is a little bit of money and buy your way out of trouble. And three, a little charm and charisma. You're going to schmooze your way through life." He just looked at me and said, "You, my boy, have nothing to worry about." And he was right. You know, I was a blank slate, you know. And if you think you got a story that's so horrific that you don't belong here, people can't imagine, you know, hang that stuff out in the door. You know, you think you're too smart for this, hang that stuff out there. It's not going to help you here. You know? I've been blessed. I came here for the purpose of sobriety. And when you come here for the purpose of sobriety, most of the time you get it. You come here looking for other things. You may get those things, but it's not going to give you that sobriety. When I've come here to really maintain that sobriety date, I've done it. No matter all the highs and lows I've had in my life, career successes, lows, marriage, divorce, as long as I've come here, I've been okay. I'm married now, very happily married. I got an almost 6.5, 7-year-old daughter. She loves me so much. My relationship with my daughter is just like, when she hugs me and says, "Daddy, I love you," every bone in my body believes she loves me. I know what it's like for people to care for me and not feel worth that love. I know what it's like to have so many people worry about me and not let them in. My wife and I relationship, it's not the same. We built a relationship together. It's different, you know. But that pure relationship that was built in love with my daughter, it's just so amazing. And I get to enjoy that, and I get to live in that. And if you're new, hold on to this thing. There's more available in AA than people are willing to ask for. And it's there. Ask for it. I can see enough people are trying to get out of their seats, so I'll speak for about another 25 minutes. But I love being here, and I'm just the energy here. If you could take anything home, my suggestion to anybody new here is if you could take anything home, just look at all the people that are here and just think about how many people love them into sobriety. And if you ever have a doubt of what's available in AA, think about that, because it's here and it's all for us. Thanks.